Welcome back to Making Waves. We continue with our exploration of New Orleans, a year after Hurricane Katrina. Next, we have Michael Parente with The Free Market Killed New Orleans.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parente. Michael Parente is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparente.org.
How the Free Market Killed New Orleans. The free market played a crucial role in the August 2005 destruction of New Orleans and the death of hundreds of its residents. Knowing that a momentous hurricane might hit that city and surrounding areas, what did officials do? They played the free market. They announced that everyone should evacuate. Everyone was expected to devise their own way out of the disaster area by private means, just like people do when disaster hits free market countries throughout the Third World. It's a beautiful thing, this free market, in which every individual pursues his or her own personal interests and thereby affects an optimal outcome for the entire society. That's how the invisible hand works its wonders in mysterious ways. In New Orleans, there would be none of the regimented evacuation that occurred in Cuba. When a powerful Category 5 hurricane hit Cuba last year, the Castro government, abetted by neighborhood citizens' committees, evacuated some 1.5 million people, more than 10% of the country's population. The Cubans lost 20,000 homes in that hurricane, but not a single person was killed. This feat went largely unmentioned in the U.S. press. On day one of Hurricane Katrina, it was already clear that hundreds had perished in New Orleans. Media reporters explained that the people stayed because they were just plain stubborn. It was only by day three that they discovered that hundreds of thousands of people stayed because they had no way of getting out and no place to go once they got out. They had no cars and no cash, and so they sat tight, hoping for the best. In the end, the free market didn't work so well for them. Many were low-income African Americans, along with fewer numbers of poor whites. It should be remembered that most of them had jobs before the flood hit them. That's what most poor people do in this country. They work, usually quite hard, sometimes more than one job at a time. They are poor not because they're lazy, but because they are paid poverty wages while burdened by high prices, high rents, and regressive taxes. The free market played a role in the disaster in other ways. George Bush's agenda throughout his presidency has been to cut government services to the bone and make people rely on the free market sector for the things they might need. So he sliced $71 million from the budget of the New Orleans Corps of Engineers, a 44% reduction. Plans to fortify New Orleans levees and upgrade the system of pumping out water had to be shelved. In addition, many of the engineers had started work to build new levees several years ago, but many of them were taken off such projects and sent to Iraq. And the president then also cut $30 million in flood control appropriations. For New Orleans, most of the destruction was caused not by the hurricane, which swerved and hit Mississippi harder, but by the flood that came when the levees broke. Afterward, Bush said, quote, "I don't think anyone anticipated that breach of the levees." Another untruth tumbling from his lips. The catastrophic flooding of New Orleans had been predicted for some years by storm experts, engineers, Louisiana journalists, state officials, and even some federal agencies. In their campaign to starve out the public sector, the Bush reactionaries allowed developers to drain vast areas of wetlands. Global warming, also a product of the free market, has destroyed other wetlands that had been a flood barrier for New Orleans. So again, that old invisible hand of the free market that was supposed to take care of things didn't really work very well. The developers pursuing their own private profit were expected to devise outcomes that would benefit us all. They did not. There are those who say that government doesn't work. Look how poorly it performed, how ineptly, in New Orleans. To be sure, government doesn't work. certainly not when it's in the hands of reactionaries who have no desire for it to work. New Orleans was victimized by those right-wing ideologues who oppose the idea that government can be a salutary force in regard to social needs and human services. Bush was unable to take care of the people of New Orleans, but he was able to take care of that tiny fraction of 1%, the super-rich, who picked up all the fat contracts in regard to New Orleans. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org.
Everybody knew that it could happen. Likelihood was clear, the future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, 'cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding, just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said, now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted, inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, 'cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. And years of war, no evacuation plan. It was just that the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses, no one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. And the people died, then they died some more. They drowned inside their attic. An army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember those sad and awful days, when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water, they died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans. Here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth, where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is the place we're heading towards, where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans.
That was David Rovics with New Orleans. stay tuned for the last half hour of our show, Between the Lines, with another interview about the current state of New Orleans. Turning to other issues, we now bring you Jav Parrish with After November, about the upcoming elections.
After November. This is Jav Parrish. Booting Republicans out of power in one or both houses of Congress this fall is a worthy goal, if for no other reason than accountability. But there's no guarantee a Democratic victory can bring accountability. In the next 9 weeks, we also need to be working to improve the odds that giving Democrats a taste of Capitol Hill power will, in fact, make things better. Let's count a few of the many ways in which this is not a given. First of all, there's Iraq. 60% of Americans oppose that war, but it's still hard to find a major Democratic Party leader who agrees with this landslide majority. Instead, it's now become fashionable for such leaders to backpedal only by criticizing the conduct of the war. The U.S. can't win the war in Iraq any more than George Bush can walk on water. Democrats claiming that they can walk on water better won't just lead to more drownings. And hey, has anybody in either party noticed yet that Afghanistan is in the very same handbasket? Or take Iran. If Democrats lack a plan in Iraq, they seem to have one for Iran. Shut up and keep letting the White House lead us into a disastrous region-wide war. Well, they're not always silent, as when Israel attacks Lebanon, a move green-lighted in May by the Bush administration. They saw it as a preemptive way to keep Hezbollah from retaliating against Israel when we attack Iran. The Democrats were right there with the Republicans. War with Iran is still a very real threat. It's not just foreign policy where Democrats need to be pressured. Maybe, just maybe, with the Middle East disintegrating, gas prices having tripled in 5 years, and the globe warming up, it's time to start weaning this country from fossil fuels. What do Democrats want to fund? We don't really know. And don't expect Democrats to take on global warming. That's Al Gore's issue. No other party leader with 2008 ambitions will want to touch it until it's clear Gore isn't really running for president. Speaking of cynical inaction, if Democrats win in November, they could finally launch real investigations of Bush administration crimes. But again, don't count on it. There's no evidence yet that Democratic leadership has any interest in encouraging such behavior from its new chairs. They don't want to risk a divisive political climate in the run-up to 2008. Plus, Bush can use national security and executive privilege claims to tie up investigations into 2008 anyway. And who decides such claims? A judiciary dominated by Republican opponents? And speaking of the courts, if John Paul Stevens leaves the Supreme Court in the next 2 years, as is widely expected, can Democrats be counted on to seriously oppose yet another reactionary lifetime appointment? Four words. John Roberts Samuel Alito. The list goes on. Budget and trade deficits, an end to the housing boom, stagnant or declining real wages, massive consumer debt, a quickly weakening dollar. The Bush administration is still busily pushing negotiations on a number of new free trade deals, including one with South Korea being negotiated next week in Seattle. Healthcare, stopping yet more attempts to privatize or raid Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Coastal and Alaskan oil drilling, and a host of other environmental issues. More attacks on 400 or so years of scientific thinking. On all these, are Democrats offering real alternatives? A chance to at least block 2 more years of Bush pillaging? Or are they simply redistributing some of D.C.'s legalized bribery? What can we do? Democratic candidates for Congress, incumbents and challengers alike, have to be challenged on these issues in the next 9 weeks. Need pressure to state real positions and commitments, not just skating by on I'm not them-ism. They need donations, too. The more that a candidate's money comes from ordinary donors, the more likely, at least in theory, that candidate will be to look out for the interests of the broader public rather than big corporate patrons. And of course, Democrats still have to win, something they haven't done lately. The greater the turnaround, the more that Democrats can claim a mandate for their policies, far greater than anything George Bush ever received. And, with some luck, they'll actually use it. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
And now for Steve Diamond on Iraq.
No more plans for Iraq. We constantly hear from those in power about mistakes in Iraq. Obviously, there were many. This directs us to wrestle more urgently with the question of how to more forcefully, efficiently, and persuasively occupy Iraq. Some of the greatest political minds in this country are being bent to come up with the best plan for Iraq. But exactly how did we get to this disastrous point? We invaded Iraq again because our leaders allegedly thought Iraq might be a threat. They wanted war for whatever reason and didn't care about any long-term consequences. After toppling the Iraqi dictatorship we used to support, we decided to stay for a while to teach the Iraqis to rule themselves according to our brand of free market democracy. This proved difficult since, for some strange reason, the Iraqis didn't trust our motives. So we've already spent years running a Hearts and Minds campaign in Iraq, complete with half-hearted rebuilding projects that mostly succeeded in lining the pockets of Halliburton, paying Iraqi journalists to write favorable stories about the occupation, and shutting down unfriendly Iraqi newspapers. It's the strategy of, if they don't know what we're up to, maybe they won't kill us. Of course, all of this is very expensive to do. We were told that fortunately, the occupation would pay for itself by selling off Iraq's oil. Bush said that the Iraqis should thank us, as many initially did for getting rid of Saddam Hussein. But it may be hard to find an Iraqi to thank us for taking their oil money to fix some of what the U.S. blew up in our unjustified invasion, while building huge permanent military bases and redesigning Iraq's economy to serve ourselves. I'm sure the search for such an Iraqi is ongoing, and when he's found, the Bush administration will try to make him the next dictator of Iraq. Despite the paternalistic and racist implications raised by many leading analysts, the Iraqis are not idiots. They are proud and highly educated, understand the history and current reality of U.S. intervention in the Middle East, and aren't ever going to be tricked into liking us and what we're doing there. While Bush no longer talks about progress in Iraq to maintain the last few shreds of his credibility, he now refers to his occupation as the lesser of two evils. If we think it's a mess with 140,000 U.S. soldiers and untold foreign mercenaries occupying Iraq, we should be terrified by the imaginary horrors of the future, rather than the expanding horrors of the present. Democrats often call this the "you break it, you bought it" theory. But that's not true. As Lindley Young put it, Iraq is not a broken pot. It is a nation that we can never own and a nation we should not be trying to own. If you break the pot, you pay for it and leave the shop. If you break a country, the people may not be able to put it back together, partnering with the bull that broke it. You do not keep the bull in the shop and expect not to break more China. As MSNBC reported, Bush said opponents of the war in Iraq who are calling for a plan to bring home troops would create a disaster in the Middle East. He said, quote, "Many of these folks are sincere and they're patriotic, but they could not be more wrong. If America were to pull out before Iraq could defend itself, the consequences would be absolutely predictable and absolutely disastrous. We would be handing Iraq over to our worst enemies, Saddam's former henchmen, armed groups with ties to Iran, and Al-Qaeda terrorists from all over the world who would suddenly have a base of operations far more valuable than Afghanistan under the Taliban." Notice that he's finally admitting that we are trying to defend Iraq from the Iraqi people, not just violent fundamentalist foreigners like Bush. Notice that all of our current worst enemies are of our own creation or amplification through our enduring history of covert funding, U.S. impatience, weapons shipments, support for dictatorships, and the brutal occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, which have helped make Sadr's militia the most effective Iraqi political and military organization. Bush's thinking is still stuck in second-generation warfare. Bases aren't critical to terrorist organizations, and according to the Bush administration's own list of state sponsors of terrorism, they already have no shortage of bases to operate from. With U.S. heavy-handedness in the war on terrorism creating more terrorists than it kills, losing control of Iraq and Afghanistan is already a foregone conclusion. And it should be. The U.S. has no right to control other countries, invading and occupying at will. If Iran succeeds in meddling in Iraqi policy where the U.S. could not, then perhaps they are kinder, gentler, more popular fundamentalist dictators than we are. We have brought together old enemies in shared righteous anti-Americanism. Repeat after me. The Iraq War is a mistake. It's also a crime and a humanitarian disaster. The Democrats have no plan to offer because most of them can't admit their original mistake of supporting the war. They also can't stop thinking about how great it would be for the U.S. economy if we could seize Iraq's oil, which is within our grasp, but impossible to secure. The only way the Democrats can win in upcoming elections is to call for U.S. military withdrawal. The only way to win the war on terrorism is to make more friends than enemies. And the only way to do that is for the U.S. to stop warmongering to control the world and lying to cover it up. You can find that column next week on nhindymedia.org, with full links to mainstream media sources.
Here's an appeal from a fellow low-power station who needs help staying on the air.
The Mike Cannon Show. Hello, this is Mike Cannon. Please help us try to stop this unexpected dismantling of our low-power community radio station, WNRB, in Wausau, Wisconsin. Central Wisconsin is a very conservative area, and we have no alternative non-corporate voices on the airways except WNRB. 93.3 WNRB was the only station that gave local community voices to the airways, as well as my more national and international show I brought each week for a whole 4 hours a week. These voices are being shut down now. Today, without warning, WNRB was shut down for reasons not made clear to us volunteers. North Central Technical College, or NTC, was kind enough to host the station for over a year now, but today shut us down. Let me assure you that we were always in FCC and NTC compliance. If the president of NTC does not at least allow us to transfer the FCC LPN license to another local organization, another alternative non-corporate voice will be snuffed out. And when will they come for you? We volunteers at WNRB, we ask you to consider giving NTC President Lori Weyers a call at 715-675-3331, extension 1060, or email her at weyers@ntc.edu, and ask her not to do anything to jeopardize our FCC license. It will cost NTC nothing. Again, Lori's email is weyers@ntc.edu, and her telephone number for the president of NTC is 715-675-3331, extension 1060. We, the volunteers of WNRB, and me from the Mike Cannon Show, thank you very much for any efforts you might offer to keep WNRB on the air. Please don't let big business rule the airways. Please help us get our voices back. Thank you.
You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nadia Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who describes a meeting between U.S. peace activists and Iraqi parliamentarians which took place in Amman, Jordan in early August. Chris Crom, executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies, who talks about the state of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast 1 year after the devastation wrought by Hurricane Katrina. And Ted Miller, communications director for NARAL Pro-Choice America, who discusses the FDA's recent approval of the Plan B morning after pill for over-the-counter sale to women over the age of 18. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The tourist haven of Oaxaca, Mexico, has been the scene of a three-month militant teacher strike that gave birth to a progressive mass movement for social justice. In late August, 3,000 teachers, students, and left-wing activists took control of 12 private radio stations, blockaded highways, and shut down the city's bus station. It was the latest confrontation between educators and the government of State Governor Ulises Ruiz, who outraged the strikers in June by sending hundreds of riot police to break up an encampment of teachers in the city's main square. A day later, 30,000 teachers and their supporters marched into Oaxaca and retook the city square as the police fled. At that point, the teachers demanded the resignation of Governor Ruiz, a member of the long-ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI. The teachers went on strike on May the 22nd and sought $125 million in wage and benefit gains, including new books and classrooms for 1.3 million students. Governor Ruiz rejected the teachers' proposal as unaffordable. Amnesty International issued a human rights alert on the excessive use of force by security forces in Oaxaca. On August 21st, one person was killed after the siege at an occupied radio station. The bitter strike serves as a warning to a politically and economically polarized Mexico. As Luis Hernandez, opinion editor of La Jornada newspaper, told the news magazine In These Times, Oaxaca contains the core contradictions in Mexican society and anticipates conflicts that will surge in other states. Faced with a decade of environmental lawsuits and upwards of $1 billion in toxic cleanup liability, ASARCO, the American smelting and refining company, a copper mining giant, played its trump card in 2005 by filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Owned by Grupo Mexico, ASARCO became profitable by simply wiping out its environmental liabilities via the bankruptcy filing. But the $1 billion toxic cleanup bill remains with U.S. taxpayers, who will likely be footing the bill. U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State, is concerned about ASARCO's cleanup in Tacoma, Washington, and is investigating